from the magnolia trees in the meadow. King harvest is surely come.
A dry summer didn't come before, which I depend on most of all.
Welcome to WPKN's Organic Farm Stand, coming to you the first and third Thursday of each month from noon to one. My name is Richard Hill. It's what do we got here, guys? I'm looking for my
February 1st,
and I brought in my sunrise sunset report. I'm trying to root around in my pockets to give us the. I actually remember it's about. We've gained about 34 minutes since the winter solstice, 34 minutes of daylight. And our sunset is, I think, today at about 5:05 p.m.
And I hear we're gaining about 3 minutes a day.
Has it gotten to that?
Oh, something like that. And that tomorrow is February 2nd, which around here is Groundhog Day. But I think it's also about halfway between the solstice in December and the equinox at the March 21st. Which has had some significance in earlier societies, I think, that particular day, not as Groundhog Day, but as that point when the sun is really, you can tell it's coming, and plants will start behaving differently.
So we are, this is an interesting...
exciting point. Yeah. The daylight's really, you know, you can feel it coming.
Yeah, and I can, my mood is changing a bit.
Indeed, yes.
Lightning along with the... environment. And so thank you, Bill, for that. And, of course, Guy Beardsley is with us as well. Guy?
Present. You know, this Groundhog Day business is pretty busy, pretty important when I was growing up. It was sort of, we became, within the family, it was a sort of a little feast day. Celebrating, because at this point you can tell the sun's effect on the snowstorms. The snow will melt a little fast, start melting a little faster. Of course, the sun is up longer, and it's also getting a better angle on the Earth. So all that's pretty important for our family. The cows didn't really. I grew up on a dairy farm, and of course, we always judge everything by how are the cows doing. And the cows actually, you could tell that they were reflecting more sunlight and were a little happier. I can't say that it reflected a whole lot more in the quantity of milk that they were doing, but they just seemed to be a happier group of people. I'm calling cows people because when I was growing up, they were more of a family than actually some of our relatives. Right. Anyway, so be it.
Good. Okay, well, we have, just to let folks know what we're going to be doing today, we do have a special guest, as usual, and this week, this show, we're going to have our good friend and great, really excellent guest that has been here several times before, Kim Stoner from the Department of Entomology at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station on Huntington Street in New Haven. She's going to be joining us by phone not too long from now, about 20 after, and she will take us on a very, very inspiring journey through the world of pollination and pollinators, and bring us up to date on a conference that she's going to be organizing and contributing to that's coming up later this month. So Kim Stoner will be joining us soon, and we may try to squeeze in some listener phone calls. Actually, the phones... maybe, Guy, as you're giving your report, your small farm report, we could entertain questions, people that have questions about winter composting or other things of that sort. Why don't we go right to your report, and you can tell us whether what the casual non-commercial farmer should be thinking about at this point in the winter You know, where do we stand now in terms of planning and actual?
Well, you know, one of the great things we've got to do is stay warm, right?
Yeah, that's good advice.
Well, of course, you really don't have to work too much to figure out all of that. I got to say that on the farm right now, we got two major effects. One of them is the black garlic. And it is flying off the shelves faster than we can put it in five cookers. We have five cookers going, and to the point where I'm afraid I'm going to run out of raw garlic before the NOFA conference, which I told Becky we got to hold off on some of this garlic because I got to go to the NOFA conference, which is what, on the 10th of March?
I think so.
Yeah, 10th of March. And so we're going to start slowing down on that, which I'm sure there's going to be people very upset at that. But, you know, we didn't know about this black garlic till last September August anyway, the Bethlehem Garlic Festival. We found out about it, and then we started getting into it and figuring out, had to go through several gyrations in order to figure out the only way you're going to really get the good black garlic is with this garlic cooker, which keeps a temperature between 78 and 86 or 82. I think there is some variations in there. And the garlic cannot touch a hot surface. And I've noticed some of our people are telling us that people are making what they claim to be black garlic by putting it in the ovens and crock pots. And in so doing, they're going to have garlic that looks like black garlic, but it's going to have a lot less nutrition in it because the heat is what will just cut out some of the great nutrition. Whereas we ferment it for 12 days. Straight 12 days on these garlic cookers, which are the only way you can do that. Anyway.
What's the temperature in those cookers?
78 to 82, and I think there's one little point in time which it goes up to 86, and then it cuts back to somewhere between 78 and 82.
It's a smart cooker, huh?
Yeah. How about that? Right. And so and the only way we can get these cookers is to order them I think through Amazon, and but they're all made in China, which is astounding to me that some enterprising United States company shouldn't be picking up and making these things. And the ones that are coming from China, the only ones we get a hold of are actually won't hold more than about 30 to 40 bulbs at one time. They have to be on shelves in there, and so they're only fermented by the air circulation in there. And they also have humidity control, too, so that they don't really dehydrate at all. But it's very important that the cooker is exactly what it's supposed to be and not a crock pot. Anyway, that's some of the individuals on black garlic. I know Becky is listening to me right now, and she's my lady in charge of these things, and she is making breads right now. And I have to point out that one of the very successful breads, which is our second thing that we're doing in the wintertime now, is the jalapeno cheddar bread, which she cuts up the jalapeno in very small pieces, and it does not overpower, but it has got a great flavor to it. And it's a freestanding loaf that we put it in these special French type of cookers, which are ceramic, top and bottom. Really very good. And then she also makes a ciabatta bread. And I mention that because both of those breads go fly off the shelves when we go to the markets. I wanted to point out an answer to your guidelines as to the way we were talking here. I want people to take a look at their kale. That they have, if they have not taken it out of the ground, if that kale stalk is still standing up straight, even though it looks like everything around it is dead, don't rip it out until we get to about the 10th of March. About the 10th of March, or maybe even a little earlier, depending upon the weather, you'll find out whether it is going to produce you some really good kale leaves. Because the spring kale leaves are almost the best thing anybody can eat at that time of the year. They're delicious, just crunchy, they're great flavor, on them, and tremendously nutritious for you. So if those kale stalks are still standing straight up, just don't rip them out, because they may give you some good kale here, and you won't have a huge window, but when those stalks start producing little kale leaves, those little leaves can be pulled off and eaten right out of hand, and they are tremendously great for you. They're probably as good as any green at any time of the year, as it would be that. Okay, so what we have going on now is we're, of course, pruning the fruit trees and hoping that we don't get too much really good warm weather before we get some cold weather, so that we don't have those peach blossoms. What they're starting to, they haven't yet, but they will be shortly if we have warm weather, starting to get a little green seed in the center. And that's what, if we get really cold weather, that's what will freeze out, and that'll take us out of the peach people, out of the peach business for the year. Let's see, we got one farmer's market that's on January and February on Saturdays at Benedict's on Purdy Hill Road in Monroe, and it's a pretty interesting market. Benedict's also has that sounds a little commercial here, but they do have separate sessions. Like last Saturday, they had a session on bees and pollination, which is what Kim is going to talk about shortly. And they had one on wild birds. It was another interesting subject. You would think they'd have the people, but that was tremendously attended, the wild bird seminar, because obviously they sell bird seed too, but that's I was surprised at the number of people that showed up for that. They had that place packed, right? Okay, let's see. What we're doing is we're working with wood, and we're obviously developing our compost. I've now not using any manure in the compost at all, so I've started a separate pile, because my other piles did have some horse manure in it. And if you develop your compost piles, or if they're not controlled with the heat, you can call them organic matter that is decomposed, and you can use that like soil. You don't have to have it restricted use if you have manure on it at all. Any kind of manure will require you to have a much delayed use on when you can use it as a side dressing primarily, or even as a primary planting fertilizer, because if you're going to use roots on it, that it has to have 120 days from the time you put it on to the time you can get the roots out. Or otherwise, if it's above the ground, 90 days, if it's got any manure in it at all. So how are we doing on time, Rich?
We're doing good. In a moment, I'll step aside and try to get Kim Stoner on the phone. I just want to mention, Guy, we've alluded to the health benefits of black garlic, and at some point we should go into that in detail. You mentioned today before the show that it's now being shown to have a beneficial remedial effect on liver issues related to alcohol consumption.
Right, absolutely. It's great for controlling cholesterol and type 2 diabetes, all of that. I don't sure what exactly it can do, except we know that it is very good for those people with type 2 diabetes is to use that. But it's a huge boost on the immune system, and it's also any infections whatsoever. It cuts out, and even colds, it helps reduce any effect of the colds that you might get. It's what we used to call a snake oil, what people would call it, anything that was going to be good for everything, called a snake oil, which is sort of probably a stretch at all, right?
There's another, I think another line we should pursue maybe at some point with some conversation research, is that hearing something about sprouted garlic, which is now deemed to have powerful remedial. And
is it fermented? This sprouted?
No.
This. I don't think it would sprout. I haven't heard about that.
No,
but
I haven't either.
The garlic, you know, as it gets longer in storage, it starts to grow, and just use it like regular garlic. And then once you plant it in the ground, it starts to grow, and that any part of it is delicious as garlic.
Right,
and
yeah.
It's not surprising that I'm not sure that one sprouting would have a lot more effect than the other.
Yeah, so I'm just looking at a piece here on a website, and it's saying that growing your own sprouts is a great way to boost your nutrition, especially if you have limited space for gardening. Sprouted seeds of various kinds. Now, in terms of garlic, you know, I would imagine that referring to a single clove of garlic just starting to sprout. So we should look into that, because apparently the sprouted garlic is deemed to have lot more protein and more antioxidants and all that stuff.
I know that the seeds, when you sprout seeds, they really change in terms of their content.
Yes. Yep.
Becky.
I have
Go ahead, Bill.
I just wanted to mention some work we're doing. I'm working with Connecticut NOFA on introducing this legislative session an act to promote healthy soils in Connecticut. And according to the USDA and the Natural Resources Conservation Service, healthy soils give us clean air and water, bountiful crops and forests, productive grazing land, diverse wildlife, and beautiful landscapes. And besides that, the soil is a large store of carbon. And if we farm in the correct way, using regenerative practices, we can bring carbon out of the air and put it in the soil. And that is one of our most powerful tools to fight climate change. It also, once that carbon is in the soil, it encourages the life, and the soil is much more responsive to resilient in the face of either droughts or deluges, which we're getting more with climate change. So it really is a good thing to have more healthy soils. And this act we're proposing to the legislature is that it would set up a program, unfortunately not funded because of the nature of the state budget process right now, but a program which would support farmers and other land managers who want to practice agriculture which builds healthy soils, which also protects the water. It's really a key issue, a key to our relationship with the planet.
Let's keep track of that. It's another good reason for us to be very active in terms of how this pretty horrible budget that was passed through all kinds of backbiting and bloodletting up at the Capitol in the fall will need to be changed in order to meet the needs of the broad spectrum of people at all income levels and demographics in our state. And it can't stand. It's got to change. And actually, you know, I think some of the legislators are realizing the damage that was done and are trying to fix parts of it, but it's going to take pressure from
a lot of us.
Yeah. So that's a really interesting track you're pursuing, Bill. So I we do have Kim Stoner on the line. Bill, why don't you take it and give us your introduction for Kim? And I know you have a long and strong relationship with her. So
I've worked with Kim for, I don't know, 25, 30 years through NOFA and with the experiment station, and just so much respect for her as a scientist, an entomologist. And she's been really, for maybe a decade or more, a key in looking at and learning about bees in Connecticut, both honeybees and the problems with them and pesticides. She's done some incredible research on that. But also, more recently, identifying different kinds of bees, learning which bees are actually pollinating crops, various crops all over New England. So she's got just a broad experience, and she's going to tell us today about a conference she's organized, which is actually the third annual conference to increase pollinator habitat in Connecticut. In fact, the name of the conference is Creating and Improving Pollinator Habitat. And I would recommend the pollinator page at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station website, which has enormous resources, including the presentations, I think, from the last two conferences, as well as lots of fact sheets that have been developed as a result of a law that was passed a few years ago with various groups, including NOFA and other environmental organizations, to really encourage the protection of pollinators in Connecticut. And Kim's on the statewide committee, which is overseeing that work. So there's lots she can tell us about. So, Kim, wonderful to have you here.
Hi, great to hear your voice, and great to be on the radio.
Yeah, it's great to have you back, Kim. I know you've been a guest that we've threaded through our shows here for several years now, approaching a decade, I think. So can't even remember how many times you've been on, but you've given us a lot of information along the way. So why don't you tell us, maybe we can start with the conference that you're planning, and that could be a springboard for further questions and comments.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so as Bill kindly announced, this is the third conference about pollinator habitat that I've organized here, and it's here at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station in New Haven on Tuesday, February 27th, with a snow date on March 1st, if it is bad weather. And it's a day-long conference, so starting at 8:30 in the morning until 3:45 in the afternoon. And I am really excited about the speakers. So over time, I've been trying to figure out what are really the issues that come up for farmers and other kinds of landowners in creating and improving their pollinator habitat. So I have a speaker from the Xerxes Society for Invertebrate Conservation, Emily May. So Xerxes is the one organization that really focuses on invertebrates. There are many, many organizations for conserving other kinds of wildlife, you know, birds and mammals and that kind of thing. But invertebrates are, you know, the small animals that rule the world in a way. And so she's going to give an overview about what bees need, the diversity of bees and their habitat needs. Cynthia Rabinowitz, who is also somebody that Bill has known for a long time, even longer than I've known her, actually, who is now the executive director of the Northwest Connecticut Conservation District, and who is a permaculture designer. So she's going to talk about a permaculture approach. So one of the things that I've found out talking to landowners is that I really need to, like, sit down with them and talk with them about what are their goals for their land, and to understand that as well as I can so that I can figure out how to fit pollinator habitat, which is, you know, part of their goals, but usually not the primary goal, into the other things that they're doing. So she's going to present a permaculture approach to doing that. Nancy Furlow, who's from the Natural Resources Conservation Service, which is part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they have funds that they can use in various farm bill programs for farms and other large landowners to create pollinator habitat, usually, again, as part of a wider plan about soil and water conservation. Steve Munno, who is an organic farmer at Massaro Farm, which is a farm that has a lot of great pollinator habitat, so he's going to talk about how they have done that at that farm. Mike Nadeau, who was an organic land care professional for many years and is now a consultant, and who will talk about site analysis and so understanding the characteristics of a particular site and choosing plants for pollinator habitat that are going to thrive there. I'm going to talk about protecting pollinators from pesticides. And my colleague, Dr. Rich Coles, is going to talk about fixed land honey production. He's very interested in honeybees in particular. He is actually working on a project to breed honeybees to be resistant to varroa mites, a terrible pest of honeybees, and he's found that a limitation on his program in being able to do that is having enough resources out there, nectar resources out there, for his honeybee hives to be able to thrive. So he's been reading all the old honey beekeeper literature about fixed land honey production and how to maximize nectar. And he's also going to talk about diversionary planting. So he has a long background in planting attractive plants in order to divert insects away from other plants of interest. And so he's applying that to bees and talking about what kinds of things you could plant for bees in order to divert them away from places where pesticides have been applied. And so that's the whole program for the day. And as I said, I'm pretty excited about all of that.
It is really a nice program and really excellent speakers. We should mention that the program, in part because of its funding, is really designed for farmers and other land managers, but especially farmers, to encourage this. But I think anyone's welcome to come. There's a little fee, $30 in advance or $40 at the door.
Yes. It's supported by a specialty crop block grant from the Connecticut Department of Agriculture. So, yeah, I particularly would like to have farmers come. Yeah.
Okay.
And beekeepers. Yeah. Beekeepers are also part of agriculture, too.
Yes, of course.
And so, Kim, why don't you give us some kind of idea about what makes for a good pollinator habitat?
Maybe even before that, we ought to talk about pollinators, the kinds of bees, and then what makes pollinator habitat, because it's really an astounding story that Kim
And I think that most of us, most lay people believe that when we talk about pollinators, we're thinking about one particular...
The honeybee,
and we get a big bang for the buck on that, we not only get our plants pollinated, but we get the honey at the end of the system there. So, but tell us, give us a good picture of who are the pollinators.
Okay, yeah. So most of my work is on bees, and bees do a large proportion of the pollination of both crops and natural plants that need pollination in order to reproduce sexually. And there are about 349 species of bees in Connecticut, and honeybees are one species, so there's a lot of diversity of bees. There are a lot of other insects that are pollinators as well. Flies are actually important pollinators of a lot of crops. I was just reading the other day about cocoa and how important flies are in pollinating cocoa crops in Africa. So flies, wasps, there are some beetles that are pollinators. People also think of butterflies and moths as flower visitors, and they do some pollination. And then hummingbirds, there are a few vertebrates that are pollinators. Hummingbirds are one example. There are some bats around the world that are pollinators as well. Most of my work is on bees, but it is important to remember that there's a range of different kinds of animals. Within the bees, there are honeybees, which are familiar to most people, bumblebees, which are also familiar, I think, to a lot of people. And then there are lots of solitary bees. So honeybees are really sort of obligately social. They only really live as a colony, not as individuals. Bumblebees are social and have colonies during the summer, during the growing season, but the queen is a solitary bee from the time she mates through when she overwinters, which is what she's doing at this time of year, to when she establishes a colony the next year. But there are also a lot of bees where each female makes her own individual nest that are not social bees like the honeybees and the bumblebees that we're used to thinking of. And many species of little tiny bees that people may not even realize are bees that are called, that family is called sweat bees. Mm-hmm. And there are on the order of about 70 species of sweat bees in Connecticut. Mason bees, some people know about mason bees people create mason bee hotels, tubes where they nest, where each female makes a nest in her own little tunnel. So those are just some examples of the bee diversity. Some of them are ground nesting. Some of them nest in like hollow stems or in tunnels in wood. There's a lot of diversity.
Wow.
What have you found about their use in pollinating crops in New England? I know you've been studying that. I mean, the different kinds of bees.
So, yeah, my study, I was part of like a bigger study across New England. My own study was focusing on pumpkins and winter squash.
Uh-huh. Important crops.
And then pumpkins and winter squash. Really, the majority of the pollination is done by one species of bumblebee, Bombus impatiens, which is our most common species of bumblebee. Honeybees do some of the pollination, and there's a bee that is a specialist on pumpkins and squash that is called a squash bee that feeds its larvae only the pollen of plants in the genus Cucurbita, pumpkins and squash.
Amazing.
So bumblebees are really number one and do at least two-thirds, I'd say, of the pumpkin pollination. And then squash bees are probably number two, and honeybees are number three in terms of the pollinators.
And where do the bumblebees live?
So bumblebees nest most of the time in the ground in tunnels that have been made by other animals or sort of spaces in the ground, but oftentimes tunnels made by rodents and chipmunks and animals like that.
Hmm.
They can be in other kinds of spaces. They particularly like spaces that are well insulated, so like mouse nests that have a lot of fur lining
yeah.
them, because they need to conserve energy. The queen particularly needs to conserve energy when she's establishing her nest in the spring, because she heats up the nest in order to make her larvae develop faster.
Wow, amazing.
Wow, Kim, I don't hear anything about wasps. What's their position in this pollination business?
Oh, you know, I skipped over wasps when I was talking about different kinds of pollinators. So there are wasps that are pollinators. For the most part, wasps are visiting flowers in order to feed on nectar, and they don't have a lot of hairs the way bees do and the flies that are good pollinators do. So they're not very efficient at carrying pollen from one flower to another, but some of them are pollinators. They are they're also different from bees in that bees use pollen as their source of protein. That's like a defining characteristic of bees. And wasps typically use other insects, for example, or similar kinds of animals as their source of protein. So wasps tend to be predators on other insects or parasites of other insects.
So we like to get rid of the wasps for the most part.
No, not if they're getting insects that might otherwise be troublesome, right?
Well, now, how about that? They do after charge around and get the these bad insects, too? Or are there any bad insects?
Well, so there are you know, it's from an agricultural point of view, which is, you know, we're talking a farm stand here. So there are insects that are pests on crops. So wasps are used as biological control agents, actually, on some of the pests of crops.
Ticks,
so,
maybe?
Pardon?
Are the wasps attack ticks at all?
There are parasitic wasps that attack ticks. I don't know that they have a really large impact on ticks, but I know that my colleague Kirby Stafford did some work looking at parasitic wasps on ticks. Yeah.
What about mosquitoes? Is there any?
So I don't know that wasps. Probably some of the predatory wasps would catch mosquitoes. I don't know of wasps that are parasites of mosquitoes. A lot of the predators of mosquitoes are actually other mosquitoes. There are mosquitoes that are blood feeders and other mosquitoes that are predators on their fellow mosquitoes. So not all mosquitoes are bad.
What a fascinating world it is that you present to us. Maybe let me bring it back just a bit to pollinator habitat, which is what we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And mention when we think about pollinator habitat and growing flowers is really comes to mind first, the right kind of flowers for those. But as we've pointed out with the mouse nest and stuff, we really need places to live year-round, and many of them need sources of nectar and pollen, which is going to change over the course of 8 months or 10 months of the season. So maybe a little bit about that, and then we can talk maybe a little bit about the plants that are particularly valuable.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so let me stop a second and drink some water because I'm getting a little hoarse. Hang on. Okay, so the bees that are active over a long growing season really need pollen and nectar over that long growing season. So honeybees that are active from as soon as it gets warm enough for them to start to fly until it gets too cold for them to fly really need good sources of nectar in particular, and pollen at times when they're raising a lot of larvae through that whole season. Bumblebees particularly need sources of nectar and pollen at the beginning and at the end of the season because the queens, when the queen is establishing her nest, she has to go out and forage for the nectar and the pollen to establish her nest before and she produces any workers. And as I said, she heats up the nest, so she essentially sort of burns nectar in order to keep her body temperature up, to heat up the nest, to raise her larvae. And so she really consumes a lot of nectar at the beginning of the season. And then at the end of the season, the new queens really need to fatten themselves up. They need a lot of pollen and nectar because unlike honeybees that can store pollen and nectar in their hives, bumblebees only can store the resources to get through the winter in their own bodies, so they have to bulk up. So they feed a lot, for example, on goldenrod and the late asters in the fall as well. So these social bees definitely need good sources through a whole season. Then the solitary bees are sometimes only active for a short time. So they would come out, they would need their resources during the maybe 6 weeks or so that they're out as adults. They collect the pollen and nectar they're going to feed to their larvae at that point, and then the larvae are developing through the rest of the season. So for a whole wide range of pollinators. You want to have blooming plants through the long season. As you said, you also need to be thinking about the diversity of habitats that they have. One way to think about that that people say is just not to clean up everything so much, to have hollow stems out there in the environment, to have piles of wood that you might have rodents nesting in, and that you might have some of these wood nesting bees and nesting in, that kind of thing.
Kim, I notice our lavender, which we have about half an acre of now, it really has a huge number of what appear to be bumblebees. That they seem to live in it. And I get very upset if you happen to want to grab a piece of something that they're on, and so they'll sting you without too much hesitation. But how is lavender for a pollinator?
Well, it's interesting. There was a study done in England looking at different varieties of lavender. So there are big differences between the different varieties of lavender in how attractive they are to bees. So when we breed plants, we're often not thinking about the function of the flowers in feeding pollinators, because we usually, you know, we're not harvesting the seeds of the lavender. So we aren't caring too much about whether the lavender gets pollinated or not. And so sometimes we breed away the characteristics that make them attractive. So so there are some varieties of lavender that are hugely attractive, as you say, often very attractive to bumblebees. And there are other varieties of lavender that really we've sort of bred that characteristic out of them.
How about that? Do you have names for these? I know we have about 7 kinds of lavender, but I know there are many other kinds, too.
I'd have to go back and look at the paper. I don't have
That's
all
okay.
Those
That's
names
all right.
At the top
Thank
of
you.
My head.
But what you've done, you've touched on a subject that I'm going to get my son-in-law to charge around on, and we'll try to, when we keep adding to our lavender crop each year. So we're going to come up with the pollinators that we know. So he'll change. He'll find that out.
Yeah, I can send that to him if you want to give me his contact information, and I'll find that paper and send it to him.
Okay, I'll give you a call on that.
Okay.
And maybe for a minute we should remind people that we're talking about a Creating and Improving Pollinator Habitat Conference, which will be held on February 27th at the Connecticut Agriculture Experiment Station in New Haven. And you can find out more through the station's website at ct.gov/CAES, standing for Connecticut Agriculture Experiment Station.
Right, and you can look on in the left-hand column there, and there's an item that says pollinator information, and that's the place to find all that information.
And our guest today is Kim Stoner, who's really, I guess, the head entomologist at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. Did I overstep your...
Yeah, okay. You did.
She's a very long-serving entomologist there who's been very active in supporting non-chemical approaches to things and teaching farmers and others about insects and how they can work together.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, thanks. There are other entomologists who are higher up in the administration than I am, so I'm not the head entomologist. But
nobody that knows more, though, than you do.
You'll always be our chief, our head entomologist. So maybe could you talk a little bit about how the sort of the interface between the reduction of pesticide use and chemical-free farming and pollinators? Like, how do these two things work together to create better, not only habitat for the pollinators, but also better gardening practices?
So, I have done quite a bit of studying of routes of exposure of pesticides to roots of exposure of bees to pesticides. So, and actually collaborating with a really wonderful chemist in the experiment station as well, Brian Eitzer, Dr. Brian Eitzer in the analytical chemistry department. And bees are exposed to quite a wide range of different pesticides, and we're still trying to get a good handle on how much pesticide is a hazard to bees and what kinds of pesticides. I think we keep discovering more all the time about possible hazards that we had not thought about before. So, one of the things that we have to think about when I do this pollinator habitat conference, as I mentioned, is that on farms that are using pesticides that are also dependent on pollinators for example, fruit set in orchards, they need to sort of balance their pest management with their encouragement of pollinators. And they have to, so if they're going to plant pollinator habitat, they have to think about where they're going to be using pesticides and how to create pollinator habitat away from where the pollinator is going to be exposed to pesticides. So one way to do that is to put buffers in between. Another way that Rich Cole is going to talk about is to try and attract the pollinators away from where the pesticides are being applied. But that is actually sort of a tricky balance for farmers. And then, as you say, if you're an organic farmer and you're minimizing your use of pesticides, and mostly the pesticides that organic farmers use are pretty short-lived in the environment, so that they are not going to be continuing to be a source of exposure if you're spraying them before the plants are in flower or after the plants are in flower. They're not going to be a continuing problem, whereas some of the other pesticides are systemic in the plant, and this is something I've done a lot of studying on, actually, is systemic pesticides that can be applied when the plants are not in flower, but they travel through the plant and to some extent contaminate the pollen and nectar of the plants. For example, there are these pesticides that are called neonicotinoids that are in large part used as seed treatments, applied to the seeds of crops that we grow on a large scale, corn, soybeans, wheat, canola, things like that. And they are they're applied on the seed, but they are taken up by the plant to some degree and go through the plant and to some degree end up in the pollen and nectar. But they're also very long-lived in the environment. So people are starting to study more about whether there's a buildup over time when people use even when they're rotating crops, but they are rotating crops that are all treated with these pesticides, these systemic pesticides, and to what extent that buildup then contaminates flowering plants that might be on the edges of the field. And this is not really a pollinator issue, but they're also starting to look at to what extent those pesticides, which are pretty water-soluble, end up in water bodies, in streams. And there was just a study looking at movement into the Great Lakes. And to what extent they affect aquatic insects, which are also important in the overall ecosystem. That's what a lot of birds feed on, actually, is aquatic insects, things like mayflies and stoneflies and caddisflies that are aquatic.
So the neonicotinoids in general are not good things, although farmers like to use them. I guess they're very effective, but they seem to be bad actors in the environment, although that's probably not something that is you should say. But I want to point out one of the resources on the Experiment Station's website is the Planting Flowers for Bees in Connecticut publication, which Kim wrote, and which has wonderful lists of various flowers, wild and grown, and when they flower and what kind of bees they attract. It's really an exciting resource for those who want to create some pollinator habitat in their yard or farm or garden.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Another thing that is on the website that I wrote is also A Citizen's Guide to Creating Pollinator Habitat in Connecticut. So that was actually written as a result of the pollinator health law that was passed a couple of years ago. And so in that, I'm trying to address different groups of people who might have different goals. So there's a part that's for beekeepers. There's a part that's for farmers who are interested in generalist bees that would be likely to pollinate crops. And then there's a part for large-scale landowners who are trying to sort of restore ecosystems. And that part really focuses on native plants for pollinators.
Kim, this is off the subject a little bit, but are there any mechanical pollinators that people seem to be trying to develop, or is that completely out of the question?
So people have looked at creating sort of a robotic bee that would be able to carry pollen from one flower to another. And there are places where people do a lot of hand pollination. It was a story a number of years ago now, probably 7 or 8 years ago now, about orchards in China where people were hand pollinating the flowers in order to get fruit set because of that really heavy pesticide use, they had lost their natural populations of pollinators. So there are ways that people can do it mechanically themselves, and there are people who have tried to invent devices to do that. The best thing, I think, would be to conserve what nature has given us as a way to do that. So,
very important point. And we're coming up. We're almost done for the day. It's been wonderful to have you with us, Kim. We've been talking to Dr. Kim Stoner, who's an entomologist at the Connecticut Agriculture Experiment Station, talking about her conference, Creating Habitat for Pollinators in Connecticut, which will be on February 27th. And maybe you have the best way to find you on the web.
Yeah, so the address that you gave actually is good, ct.gov/CAES, but then you can have another slash and pollinators, and that takes you right to the pollinator information page, and that and at the top of that page is the information about the event.
Thank you so much.
Kim, you do great work, absolutely.
And just the world of bees you took it into and their lives cycles, it's just fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
The diversity of life here in Connecticut.
All right. Thank you so much, Kim Stoner, and we'll be talking to you again soon, because it seems like every time we do talk to you, it opens up the mind, just begins to expand, and many questions crop up that we want to pursue on another occasion. So please come back, and good luck on the conference, and we'll hope to see many of our listeners there.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, and we are winding down here, the Organic Farm Stand on February 1st. One more time, I'll tell you that sunrise today was at 7:02 a.m., and we have until 5:08 before the sunset, so that's a good starting to be a nice mood elevating amount of sunlight and daylight that we have today. Thanks for joining us on the Organic Farm Stand, everybody. And thanks, of course, to Bill Dusing and to Guy Beardsley, our wonderful panel. My name is Richard Hill. We'll be back in 2 weeks with
Jeff Korjalak, the executive director of Connecticut NOFA, who tell us about their conference coming up on March 10th in Danbury. It's the largest agricultural conference in the state and a very good time.
Indeed. And we'll take it up in 2 weeks. Thanks, all. See you soon.
Righto.
Because if you don't have it, what good is having wealth? Well, I can tell by the look in your eyes.
Programming support comes from New Morning Market, the independently owned organic market whose mission since 1971 has been to build a local, healthy, and sustainable food community. Offering local organic produce and humanely raised meats, sustainably harvested seafood, and prepared to order organic juices, smoothies, and meals to dine in or take out. Located at 129 Main Street North in Woodbury, Connecticut. More information at newmorn.com. Good food, good people, good life. New Morning Market.
This is Peggy Nelson, co-host with Richard Feniger of WPKN's weekly arts and culture show called State of the Arts. Join us every Friday at noon to hear our conversations with area cultural organizations, theaters, actors and actresses, and other leading voices from the world of the arts, here at 89.5 FM and streaming at WPKN.org.
This is Caroline Doctorow, and I hope that you'll join me this Saturday night at 7 p.m. for Song Trails, a celebration of folk and roots music with well-known artists and others that are a bit below the radar. So that's Song Trails with me, your host, Caroline Doctorow, here on WPKN 89.5 on your FM dial and streaming live at WPKN.org.
Attention music lovers, WPKN's Music Mash Record Fair is coming to Bridgeport on Saturday, March the 3rd. We'll have thousands of vinyl LPs, 45s, CDs, music collectibles in all genres from rock to jazz to blues and soul from more than 50 of New England's biggest dealers. It all happens in downtown Bridgeport on Broad Street at Reed's Art Space, home to Music Mash 18. We'll have WPKN DJs and celebrities spinning music, as well as food options and beer from our sponsors Two Roads Brewing and Brewport. We'll also have coffee and bagels for the early bird shoppers. Reed's Art Space is just minutes from Metro North.